So we had this long period of basically complete silence on the Congressman Matt Gaetz investigation and possible forthcoming charges. Then last week, we learned that Matt Gaetz's ex-girlfriend had testified before a grand jury. And now things moving significantly more quickly. We have learned that Matt Gaetz's ex-girlfriend has been granted immunity in the sex trafficking probe investigating the congressman. So let's kind of back it up and reset the entire thing. I believe it was in March of 2021. I remember where I was. We were on break that week. News broke that Matt Gaetz was being investigated for a number of possible crimes. Matt Gaetz is the radical Trumpian Republican congressman from Florida. He's an absolutely horrible extremist in every sense of the word and in every sense of the every aspect of him falls under that category. The charges that were being looked at, and remember, he has not been charged with anything yet. That's sort of the whole point of this. It includes charges stemming from possible actions involving paying people for money and the transportation of underage women between states, which would make it a sex trafficking case. And then, as we expected charges any day, basically nothing happened. He did lawyer up, hiring some of the best sex crime lawyers in the country, but nothing happened. And many of you started to email me asking what's going on with that. Is the story dead? And of course, I don't know. Last week, we learned that Matt Gaetz's ex-girlfriend testified before a grand jury. And this was one of the first recent signals that this thing is not only still going on, but could be getting very serious. And now we have learned that Matt Gaetz's ex-girlfriend has been granted immunity in the sex trafficking probe. Now, there are a number of different takeaways from this, which we're going to talk about. But as CBS News reports, prosecutors granted immunity to an ex-girlfriend of Representative Matt Gaetz before she testified last week in front of a federal grand jury. Gaetz has been under investigation to determine if he violated sex trafficking laws and obstructed justice in that probe. Gaetz has previously denied all wrongdoing and has said that he has never paid for sex nor had sex with an underage girl. The woman who CBS News is not naming testified last Wednesday. She is viewed as a potential key witness, according to two sources. One of the sources said she has information related to the investigation of both the sex trafficking and obstruction allegations. CBS News legal analyst Ricky Kleiman says, quote, "This may be a willing participant who has a smart lawyer who sought an immunity deal from the government. The government does not give immunity blindly, so they know what they are getting in exchange." Also, the government, or in general, people typically don't ask for immunity unless they were involved in wrongdoing in some way. And the hypothetical that's being laid out is that in Florida, failure to report child abuse is a crime. And this is all speculative, but what is being kind of discussed is if part of her testimony is that she knew of underage victims, is what they are legally, of Matt Gaetz, and she didn't report them, she could theoretically be liable for that because of Florida law, because in Florida, everybody's considered a mandated reporter. If she knew about that, she should have reported it. And so the most kind of benign interpretation of the immunity thing would be that's what it's about. She knew about it and she's only now talking about it and she could be liable. Obviously, it could be far worse than that in terms of the involvement of Matt Gaetz's ex-girlfriend. We just don't know at this point in time, but that is what's being speculated. So this is not only still going on, but it is very, very serious. Isabel Kirshner, who's one of these top sex crime defense lawyers, an attorney for Gaetz, said to CBS, quote, "We have seen no credible basis for a charge against Gaetz. We remain steadfast in our commitment to challenge any allegations with the facts and law." A source told CBS that as part of an obstruction probe, investigators are looking into whether Gaetz had a phone call with the ex-girlfriend and another woman who was already a witness in the federal investigation. Sources told CBS that the ex-girlfriend and the other woman traveled to the Bahamas with Gaetz in 2018, along with a third woman with whom Gaetz was in a sexual relationship. That third woman was 18, but investigators are looking into whether she was 17 when the sexual relationship began, which would be very bad for Matt Gaetz. Investigators are also trying to determine if any of the women were paid and were illegally trafficked across state or international lines for the purpose of sex with the congressman. You know, sort of like a common sense suggests to us that Matt Gaetz shouldn't be such a compelling person for women to be with, that if he's traveling to the Bahamas with three women, one of them was probably compensated to do it. It is, you know, we think about it and we go, well, it's tough to imagine if you're the third woman going to the Bahamas with Matt Gaetz on some kind of sex trip that you're doing it willingly. But you have to remember, 300 million people in this country, Matt Gaetz, in some very general sense, seeing as a guy, you know, with power and access to power and at the time had a relationship with Donald Trump and whatever, we shouldn't write off the possibility that someone might have done this without getting paid. But obviously, when you read about it, it's sort of like Matt Gaetz, what on earth is going on here? It is increasingly looking like there is going to be a legal problem for Matt Gaetz coming here. And the latest is immunity for the ex-girlfriend. You know, just yesterday we talked about the definition of freedom that the right adheres to right now is very authoritarian. The freedom to deny other people things, the freedom to tell others what it is they can and can't do, the freedom, you know, we talked about that yesterday. There's another element to this authoritarian slide that I think deserves its own discussion, which is that the Republican Party is moving in the direction of pulling out of future presidential debates. The Republican National Committee says it will require candidates to pledge to not participate in debates run by the Commission on Presidential Debates. What would replace them, if anything, was unclear. This is an extraordinarily authoritarian move. Now, there's sort of like the logical reason why they would do this, and then there's the reality that it fits into this bigger authoritarian picture. And we'll go through both of those aspects in a second. The New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman reported the RNC is preparing to change its rules to require presidential candidates that want to be a Republican nominee to pledge not to participate in what have historically been the official presidential debates sponsored by the Commission on Presidential Debates. Republican committee officials alerted the debate commission to their plans in a letter sent Thursday. If the change goes forward, it would be one of the most substantial shifts in how presidential and vice presidential debates have been conducted since the commission began organizing debates more than 30 years ago. The nonprofit commission was founded by the two parties in 1987. It codified debates as a permanent part of presidential elections, describes itself as nonpartisan. Republicans have complained for a decade that the process favored Democrats. The move by the RNC was an outgrowth of those long held complaints and came after months of discussions between the commission and party officials. This discussion apparently started last year. The Republican Party chairwoman, Ronna McDaniel, demanded changes be made to how debates were held. The change requiring candidates to refuse participation is to be voted on at the RNC winter meeting in February. If they move forward, it's unclear what that means for future debates. So there are two pieces to this. OK, first, let's talk about the sort of like, well, yeah, if you have no issue based platform on which you would debate, why would you debate? And what I mean by that is increasingly started with, I mean, listen, I'm not going to do the whole thing, but this started a really long time ago. But more acutely, George W. Bush became less and less issue focused and more kind of ideology based. When Barack Obama became president, Republicans went completely crazy and abandoned policy 90%. And then under Trump, there's been no more policy at all. If you don't have policy on which to debate, why would you go to a debate? OK, that sort of makes sense. But then it goes further. If you're not trying to win on the issues, right, if you're trying to win on gerrymandering, voter suppression, bogus post-election tactics, legal challenges and the like, debates don't really have a part in that. You don't really need to convince people to vote for you. And the third piece of this is that this is very on brand in terms of being autocratic and authoritarian. And former David Pakman Show guest Ruth Ben-Ghiat wrote a really good piece in her Substack called Demagogues Don't Debate. The GOP mimics Putin and Orban. Refusing to participate in presidential debates is a symptom of the Republicans' embrace of authoritarianism. This is a really good article to check out, a good blog post from Ruth Ben-Ghiat. who writes, debates between presidential candidates enact the democratic principle of mutual tolerance, the notion that those who don't share your political views have a right to free expression. The public hears an exchange of views by two individuals on equal footing, bound by the same rules, enforced by an impartial arbiter. When they say we're not going to do that anymore, it furthers this idea that, number one, they people with political disagreements can't even be in the same room as each other. But also is the a furtherance of other aspects of authoritarianism. Personality cults, as Ruth Ben-Ghiat writes, posit the leader as a man above all others. The egalitarian staging and format of debates makes them dangerous to his brand. Since authoritarians sustain power through disinformation, threat, corruption, and fixing elections, who knows what might be exposed if they submit to spontaneous questioning by a rival or a third party? And that is a fundamental aspect of this. And I won't read Ruth's entire post, but she talks about Putin understanding this and his history of refusing to debate, and talks about Orban, a Putin client who has followed that lead. Orban hasn't debated since 16 years ago, after a really bad performance in a 2006 debate. So there's two aspects of this. And there's the they don't run on policy, so why even talk to the opposition? Sure, that's fair. But then there's also yet another way in this which this idea of not getting on stage with your opponent mimics and mirrors that which we've seen other authoritarian strongmen do around the world over the last 20 years. So very much on brand with this extreme authoritarian dictatorial slide that we've seen from the Republican Party. The Republican Party will vote next month as to whether they are finalizing this decision not to participate in the debates. My instinct is they're going to do it. I don't think this, you know, it seems like the type of thing they would kind of decide beforehand. Do we have the votes for it? But we'll see next month, and we'll tell you when there is an ultimate decision made by them. In the meantime, you can let me know your thoughts about this wildly autocratic decision by finding me on Twitter at @dpacman. Our program is mostly funded by viewers and listeners through the David Pakman Show membership page, which you can find at joinpakman.com. We do an extra show every day for our members, and I would love it if you signed up at joinpakman.com. The latest bogus COVID treatment slash prophylactic slash cure, it's all of the above. In reality, it's none. Is inhaling hydrogen peroxide through an asthma nebulizer. Now, I'm going to say it a number of times throughout this segment to remain in compliance. This is a bad idea, not evidence-based, not recommended by actual doctors, and can be very harmful to your health. So don't nebulize hydrogen peroxide through asthma inhalers. I'm merely telling you that there are people doing it. Last week, we talked about so-called urine therapy, which involves drinking urine, rubbing it on your skin, using it in a neti pot. You know, it does not do anything for COVID, despite what that crazy guy I told you about last week says. The new one is inhaling aerosolized, I guess we would call it, hydrogen peroxide. This is wildly spreading. And it's crazy because we had this long weekend. I check back in on the news when we get back from the long weekend, and all of a sudden, hydrogen peroxide inhalation is everywhere. So here's one guy explaining how the hydrogen peroxide protects him not only from COVID, but from people shedding vaccine on him, which is a whole other insane, widely debunked thing. And again, as a pre-disclaimer, essentially nothing that you're going to hear in this clip is accurate. So let's take a listen.
There's been a lot of articles saying, oh, this is terrible for you. Don't ever do this. Don't ever inhale nebulized hydroperoxide. But
hydroperoxide.
If a doctor's going to go on and actually say to do this, you know, I trust in the one doctor. Again, I forget his name, but I'll post the video.
There's one doctor who is saying to do this, and the guy doesn't remember that doctor's name. But all the other ones are saying don't. He trusts the one doctor whose name he doesn't remember.
videos. Mercola has a conversation with him in a Rumble.
And by the way, anytime you hear the name Dr. Mercola, head for the hills, folks.
They're also on BitChute, where they talk about the guy's been...
BitChute. What on earth is happening?
...doing this since the 90s. Now, he also utilizes iodine, puts like a drop of iodine.
The iodine thing also was floating around a few months ago. That's totally debunked as well.
Iodine into the medicine bottle here. I haven't tried that yet. I'm going to try it. I've actually got some on order and see. The iodine that they're recommending, I think, is it costs like $9 for two little bottles.
Doesn't this guy just inspire confidence in terms of medical treatments?
Rolls or something like that. So, again, there are different ways to do it, but I find that this is the easiest way. Plus, you got it, like, you know, in the fridge and it's ready to go. So whenever I go to a rally or I'm going to a restaurant or I went to the movies the other night and stuff like that, and, you know, I don't ever wear a mask, so
right.
Not that they help, but the first thing I do is I come in and I put one of these on.
Isn't that brilliant? He says, I do this because I don't ever wear a mask, even though the masks don't help. Well, then why do you need to do something in lieu of wearing a mask? Like, you could analyze every sentence and it wouldn't make any sense.
Also, I don't have to wait for that. To be honest with you, when I get up in the morning, I do this. And since then, I haven't been taking any antihistamines, anything like that. I haven't been taking any cold medication. I haven't had any, like, congestion. My sleep has been a lot better. And I attribute it to this.
Now, I want to point something out. And he says,
this is the only thing that I've done this.
He attributes it to this. Anytime this starts, this is a very common thing in general in the kind of quack cures thing, which is they start to tell you it basically cures and treats everything, you know, and this has been floating around for a long time. And it's everything from, you know, you can find that drinking colloidal silver, it basically it treats everything, or pomegranate, or anytime something treats so many conditions and deals with so many symptoms, aside from the fact that this is not a medical professional, we should all be skeptical.
And really different. So nebulizer.
Unless it's like, you know, maintaining a regimen of a good diet, exercise, going outside every single day. It's like, yes, that all together, that entire lifestyle is good for a lot of different things. But whenever it's like hydrogen peroxide treats all these things, we should be very skeptical.
$80, $90 with tax. I would say $8 to $10 for the food grade 12% hydrogen peroxide. For $100, I think it's worth it. And again, like I said, I went to the movies the other night in Pasadena. You don't have to show a vax card, and we didn't wear a mask, and we're in the, you know, in there with a bunch of, you know, vaxxed out people shedding all over us and everything like that. Even though they got masks on, I put, you know, first thing I did as soon as I got home is I hit this. It takes about 10 minutes to go to the end here. And you can watch TV while you're doing it. It's not that intrusive. It's a little.
So he's using it, interesting, to protect himself not only from the virus, but also from vaccine shedding, which, again, we've debunked all of this. So do not inhale hydrogen peroxide. OK, Healthline has published extensively on this. It can hurt your lungs. It won't prevent COVID. There is a quote from the AAFA, which is the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America. They said hydrogen peroxide can be used as a cleaner and stain remover and can cause tissue damage if you swallow it or breathe it in. Dr. Len Horvitz, who's a nationally recognized pulmonary specialist, said that this could seriously harm people. Quote, the very beginning of this, let's talk about things that are ridiculous. Way back in March of 2020, I had a patient send me something from what seemed to be a scientific study that explained the virus is inactivated by heat and suggested putting a hairdryer up to your nose 5 minutes every day. Maybe they were just trying to sell hair dryers. Don't do this, guys. It's extraordinarily dangerous. It's a very, very bad idea. And what's endlessly fascinating as a sort of detached observer is they seem determined to try anything other than the vaccine, which we know is very likely to keep you out of serious COVID. Anything else they'll try, iodine, hair dryer up your nose, nebulized hydrogen peroxide, urine therapy. But we've got the vaccine. It's FDA approved. It works really well at preventing serious illness. And yet that they don't seem to want. It's truly incredible. It's like they're determined to thin themselves out, either by getting COVID and dying or by using dangerous so-called treatments, which are not actually treatments. And again, just as a reminder, this is an unproven treatment that shouldn't be called a treatment that can hurt you. So do not nebulize hydrogen peroxide. We've had a lot of these different stories of casually anti-vaccine people dying of COVID. And these are stories that are very controversial within even my audience about should we feel sympathy? Should we feel glee? Should we feel both? Should we feel neither, or whatever the case may be? We now have a story of a very well-known, long-time anti-vaccine leader who has died of COVID. This is an Italian individual named Luigi Marilli. All of the articles about him, almost all of the articles that I found, are in Italian. So we're looking at a translation on Reddit about this. And as the story goes, Luigi Marilli, 63, the leader of the no-vax movement in Abruzzo, died after suffering from COVID. Remember that there is a significant anti-vax movement in Italy. Italy has, we talked about this predating COVID when it came to measles, big problem in parts of Italy. The activist died in the hospital where he was hospitalized. He was the territorial representative for his region of Liberiamo l'Italia and was among the first to fight the war against vaccines and the Green Pass obligation. He had been living in Abruzzo for some time, was always in the front line, chaired all the main protest events in the city, in the streets in recent months. This is a Google translation. That's why the syntax is sort of weird. The protest comrades gave the news of their leader's death on Facebook without ever mentioning the cause. News like that of the death of our beloved Luigi Marilli, a member of the National Direction of Liberiamo l'Italia, one of the founders of the Liberation March and spokesman, they write in a note, are those that would never want to receive. His strength of mind testified by the tireless activity of guiding and coordinating the Abruzzo Committee and the other resistance forces came from the certainty and pride of always fighting for justice, equality, freedom. It never mentions what actually happened. And if you scroll through the comments, you see a post from his friend Marino Ricciuti, who says he died of COVID. He died of COVID. This is not a joke, guys. This is a very serious situation. And you have not only casually anti-vaccine people like the right wing radio host who is like, yeah, I'm not getting vaccinated. I don't need that. And then they get sick and then they die. This is a long time anti-vaccine leader. Now, does it make it more tragic that this was an anti-vaccine leader? No, it doesn't make it more tragic, but it should just serve as a stark reminder that your opinions really don't matter. We've got a bell curve, and there are a lot of people in the middle of that bell curve who will sort of get a little sick and then recover. And then you've got people at one end of the bell curve who just will never get it, even despite multiple exposures, or they'll be asymptomatic. And then on the other side of the bell curve, you've got people who are going to die from this. And they might be anti-vax as a career, like this guy. And it doesn't matter. It's not something I point and laugh at. But we should remember that for all of these different groups that spread the disinformation, it's not only the unvaccinated that are dying. It's the anti-vax activists that are dying as well. This was a well-known guy who was known in the anti-vax community of Italy, and he has now died of COVID. We'll have more on this on our Instagram, which you can find at David Pakman Show. We'll take a quick break and be right back. This is super interesting. Many of you know about Republican Congressman Kevin McCarthy. Now, Kevin McCarthy is a guy who back around the Trump riots was speaking regularly, not only with Donald Trump, but with other people in that circle. And CNN has unearthed audio of Kevin McCarthy saying, I spoke to Trump and Trump admitted he has some responsibility for the riots to me. Now, Why is this relevant? It's relevant because for the last year plus now, year and 2 weeks, almost to the day, Donald Trump and people around him have been denying that Trump had anything to do with what ultimately took place, and or saying it was peaceful, and or saying the violence was Antifa. So all of those different things conflict. Some of them cancel each other out. Doesn't matter. The point is they've gone out of their way to say Trump, there's no responsibility here for Trump whatsoever for what happened on January 6th. And yet, CNN unearths audio of Kevin McCarthy saying Trump admitted responsibility for the riot. CNN's K file resurfaced the top House Republicans' comments to a California radio station days after the January 6th insurrection. Let's just listen to the audio. Take a listen to exactly what Kevin McCarthy said.
I say he has responsibility. He told me personally that he does have some responsibility. I think a lot of people do. But what I proposed, which I think history will say I'm right because it's the right thing to do, I believe, have a bipartisan commission and get all your facts. Actually work through the grand jury to find out at the end instead of predetermining whether someone's guilty or not.
Wow. I mean, it's not only a good idea, have a special committee, do a special investigation. Well, it's happening now and Republicans are essentially completely opposed to it. But Kevin McCarthy clearly says, I believe Trump has some responsibility and Trump admitted to me that he has some responsibility. This has been completely buried. Now, Kevin McCarthy was more recently asked about it. He forgot, guys. He doesn't remember. Kevin McCarthy says he doesn't remember the phone call where Trump admitted some responsibility. Days after January 6th, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy told other Republicans in a phone call that Trump claimed some responsibility for the Capitol riot, according to CNN. But during a news conference Thursday, McCarthy said he couldn't recall the phone call. Here was Kevin McCarthy asked about it. Check this out.
Did you tell House Republicans on a January 11th phone call that President Trump told you he agreed that he bore some responsibility for January 6th, as Chairman Thompson's letter indicates?
I'm not sure what call you're talking about.
And then he goes on to a different reporter. Now, notice the very specific language. I don't know what call you were talking about. That's a very different answer than I have never said nor believed Trump admitted responsibility nor is responsible. So if someone said to me, did you say that? And I go, I don't know what phone call you're talking about. It's not a denial, right? Sort of like if someone says, hey, did you call and threaten to steal pizza from a Pizza Hut? And I go, I don't know what phone call you're referring to. That's a very different answer than I've never called Pizza Hut and threatened to steal pizza. These are two very, very different reactions. And Kevin McCarthy, listen, if you have to guess what the truth is at the time, it wasn't yet clear that for a year, Trump and the people around him would deny that he had anything to do with the riot. So Kevin McCarthy said it in early January, mid-January of 2021, and meant it, and it was true. And now in retrospect, it would look very, very bad for McCarthy to say this last year of Trump and everybody around him pretending like he had nothing to do with it and there's nothing to see here. Well, a year ago, Trump admitted to me that he had some responsibility. That would look very, very bad for Trump, and it would probably put Kevin McCarthy in the doghouse. So I believe that Trump did say it. I believe McCarthy did report it at the time. And now he's just lying. And it's such a technical and specific answer. I don't know what phone call you are referring to is a world away from I've never said it because Trump never said it to me, and I don't believe that he bears any responsibility. Those are dramatically different things. When we talk about 2022, and I do believe we are now officially in the midterm period, you know, we've been talking before about usually the midterms really heat up in June or July, and this time around, it might be May. It might even be late April. I believe that with the start of Trump's 2022 rallies over the weekend and just with the amount of interest and discussion that's already taking place about specific 2022 races, including Dr. Oz, I'm sorry, Mehmet Oz. I'm doing it too. We need Mehmet Oz running in Pennsylvania with the discussions about what appear to be shoo-in Trumpists that will easily sail to re-election. You know many of their names. I won't repeat them. It seems pretty clear that the 2022 midterms have begun. And one of the reasons that the 2022 midterms are important are that if Republicans take the House in 2022, the investigation into the Trump riots is over. So there's urgency for it to be completed before the November elections. That's number one. Number two, the success of Trump endorsees in 2022 may well be a signal about 2024 in terms of Trump's interest in running, Trump's likelihood in running. Okay, that's another reason. But there's a third really important category as to why 2022 matters, which is depending on what happens in 2022, not only in the House and Senate, but very importantly, in races within states, governors, secretaries of state, and here we go now, election supervisors, the Republican Party may be in a better position in 2024 to successfully steal an election. They unsuccessfully tried to steal an election in 2020. Depending on what happens in 2022, they may be in a real position to actually succeed at stealing an election in 2024. And we have video here of Donald Trump just admitting it. This is video. And remember, they tried with Raffensperger in Georgia and it didn't work. But had different people been there in Georgia, it might actually have worked. So here, Donald Trump, in a video message to the Pennsylvania Republican Party, he explains why he is focusing on supervisor of elections races in 2022. He's admitting the strategy out loud, my friends. Take a look at this.
It'll be a lot sharper the next time when it comes to counting the vote. There's a famous statement, sometimes the vote counter is more important than the candidate, and we can't let that ever, ever happen again. They have to get tougher and smarter.
So when Trump says we need tougher and smarter people counting the ballots, running elections, what he's saying is we need to more effectively put our people in control of elections so that when I lose, I can just have someone figure out a way to make me win. Remember him demanding the 11,000 votes?
I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break.
Right. That was with Georgia. So we've known that this is the strategy. And Donald Trump is admitting that this is the strategy. And this is one of the major reasons why Donald Trump is going to be so involved in the 2022 races. They are going to try again. And remember, we've gone through these different scenarios. If Trump had had some friendlier people in three or four states, it's not a guarantee that it would have gone a different way, but it would have significantly upped the odds that even though Trump lost, he might have been able to stay in power. It upped the odds. I'm not saying it made it likely, but it upped the odds. If Raffensperger had been willing, could have flipped Georgia, right? I mean, at the end of the day, 11,000 votes, as Donald Trump said. We've now heard from retired generals from the military who have warned and said, if the military brass had been willing and interested in helping, you could have had the assistance of the military in carrying out the coup. Trump didn't have it in 2020. What if that changed? And there is no doubt whatsoever where this is heading. Joseph Stalin said in 1923, quote, I consider it completely unimportant who in the party will vote or how. But what is extraordinarily important is this, who will count the votes and how. And he is saying that he wants them to be better at stealing elections, period. And so how do we, I've talked before about the difficulty of playing defense against this. They might have 12 strategies and we need to know all 12 and know how to defend against them. We might only know how to defend against 11. And that 12th strategy is what could be the difference maker. So they're doing gerrymandering, of course, for help at the state level. They are working on voter suppression, closing polling places, restricting early voting hours strategically, all of these different things, voter roll purges on, you know, the full list. And now openly saying we need our supervisors of elections in place in order to make this more plausible that we would succeed next time. And this is part of why 2022 is so important. I hope that the left understands the importance of 2022. Midterms, that always, you know, compared to general elections, midterms have lower turnout. And it's so kind of cliche and I don't know what other word to apply to it, to say these are very important midterms, particularly important midterms. And there's always some reason why someone will say this is the most important election in a very specific sense, which is when it comes to trying to steal the elections when they don't win. 2022 could be the Rubicon where once it is crossed, it will be very, very difficult to go back. And so we are going to be getting back into you've got to vote. You've got to vote. And I know it became a broken record leading up to the 2020 election, but everyone must vote, not just because if Republicans take control of the House and Senate, it will be a disaster for the United States. Not just because Trumpian candidates winning makes it more likely Trump runs in 2024. And quite frankly, I think Trump in 24 beats Joe Biden or Kamala. I've said that before. Some of you agree, some of you disagree. But also because 2022 is going to be part of the plan for better positioning themselves to steal future elections, which would be an absolute and total nightmare. We're going to take a break and be back with some very interesting news headlines, your voicemail and so many other things. Stay with us. We will be right back. All right. A big story breaking this morning about the January 6th investigation. It happens to be really bad news for the Trump family. Eric Trump, as well as Kimberly Guilfoyle's phone records, have been subpoenaed and reportedly obtained by the January 6th committee, again, pushing forward into the inner circle around Trump and theoretically eventually to Trump himself. Eric Trump is one of Trump's sons. Kimberly Guilfoyle is the fiancée of Don Jr., and their records now are becoming part of the investigation. CNN reporting, exclusive, Eric Trump and Kimberly Guilfoyle's phone records subpoenaed by the January 6th committee. The House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol has subpoenaed and obtained records of phone numbers associated with one of former Trump's children, Eric Trump, as well as Kimberly Guilfoyle. It appears to be the first time the Select Committee has issued a subpoena that targeted a member of the Trump family in what marks a significant escalation of the investigation into Trump's role in the January 6th insurrection. The decision to subpoena communication records involving the Trump family underscores the aggressive tack the committee is taking as it races to complete its investigation while battling Trump in court over access to documents. The phone records obtained by the committee are part of a new round of call detail records. These records provide the committee with logs that show incoming and outgoing calls, including date, time, and length of calls. The records show a log of text messages, but not necessarily the substance or content. This is fascinating because this is the so-called metadata. And one of the things that we learned from Edward Snowden's exposures are about practices of bulk metadata collection. And one of the things that the right has been very quick to say, some on the right who want to defend government surveillance, not all of them do, the libertarian minded ones don't, but sometimes they say, listen, this is just metadata after all. It's not actually the substance and the content. It's not recordings of calls or the text of text messages. Well, that's what's here. That's what we're talking about here. And they are flipping out because they have done this with regard to Eric Trump and Kimberly Guilfoyle. Both Eric Trump and Guilfoyle played prominent roles in Trump's Stop the Steal efforts, including Guilfoyle fundraising off of the lie that the election was stolen. They both spoke on the January 6th rally that led to the attack on the Capitol. The records may help the committee flesh out text messages and phone records from others like Mark Meadows, fundraisers and rally organizers. CNN reported last month that the committee already subpoenaed phone records of more than 100 different people. The newly obtained records include the cell phone number used by Eric Trump. The cell phone number for Guilfoyle was confirmed by sources familiar with her number and texts. The committee previously identified the number as Guilfoyle, so they already knew that. There is no indication the committee has directly subpoenaed either Eric Trump or Guilfoyle for interviews or documents, nor is there any evidence that the committee subpoenaed records related to Trump's other kids, Ivanka, Don Jr., or son-in-law Jared Kushner. Now, Ivanka and Jr. and Jared, they can't really be far behind, is my instinct on this. And Trump's relationship, you know, the same way that Trump doesn't seem to understand like how to relate to dogs, to pets. It's just this weird kind of thing. There's a similar thing with Trump's kids that we've noticed. I'm not even sure that Trump would be that upset if his kids went to prison to save his ass. I think he would be sort of embarrassed because of how it would look. But it doesn't really seem he would care that much. And as far as the timing of the investigation, understand, as I said earlier, in thinking about 2022, this committee ends if Democrats lose the House in November, made effective in January when the new House gets sworn in. So at the current pace, the idea would be they are done before the midterms. When we talk about an October surprise, it's completely plausible that the investigation will be done before the midterms and that there would be some major report with takeaways and it would be an October surprise. I just have a hard time imagining that it would affect the elections. I don't think whatever comes out of this is going to change anybody's minds, because if the committee determines Trump was responsible and here's all the people that co-conspired, that's already what we intuitively believe, based on everything we know so far and everything that's public. And the Republicans don't care. They would reelect him like that. Most of them would anyway. So on the one hand, the timing of the election makes it important for this to be completed in time. At the same time, it's hard to imagine anything that comes out of this that actually affects the midterms. If you disagree with me, if you think there's something that could actually affect the midterms and change people's minds who would otherwise vote for these Trumpian Republicans, let me know. And the sort of last piece of this is, imagine that the January 6th committee finds evidence of criminality and turns it over to the Department of Justice. It would take months at minimum after the release of the report for the DOJ to investigate and then to charge anybody. So the timing of that also would not end up affecting the 2022 midterm. So on the one hand, this is incredibly important work that must be done, and I want it to be completed at a reasonable amount of time. On the other hand, it's more for the historical record, quite frankly, and maybe for its use in 2024 if Trump does run again, than it is for affecting the 2022 midterms. If you disagree, and if you believe there is a way that this report would actually influence the midterms, let me know. You can email info@davidpakman.com. On the Tuesday show, we talked about the undeniable reality that with the start of Trump rallies this past weekend in support of 2022 candidates, the 2022 midterms have sort of officially begun. We are now, the rallies are starting. It's all starting to happen. But there's another election that I normally would not be talking about right now, but I don't think I have a choice because it's very clear has also officially begun. The 2024 Republican primary has begun. How can you tell? You can tell because Donald Trump and Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who previously were buddies, united around COVID and we're all for freedom and Ron's doing a great job opening up for WWE and UFC when everything else is closed early in the pandemic. They're now attacking each other and pretty brutally. And Trump has even started to send his cronies like Roger Stone to attack Ron DeSantis. Why Ron DeSantis? Because Ron DeSantis is Donald Trump's primary challenger right now, based on polling for 2022. So let's go through this piece by piece. Axios has a report. Trump dogs dull DeSantis ahead of potential 2024 matchup. This is from Jonathan Swan. Donald Trump is trashing Ron DeSantis in private as an ingrate with a dull personality and no realistic chance of beating him in a potential 2024 showdown, according to sources who have recently talked to Trump about DeSantis. Why it matters. The two are among the most popular Republicans in the country. As the former president eyes a 2024 run, he is irked by DeSantis's popularity and refusal to rule out running against Trump. DeSantis is a favorite of Republican voters when pollsters remove Trump. The governor also hasn't been beyond tweaking his fellow Floridian. DeSantis said on the Ruthless podcast, one of his biggest regrets was not speaking out much louder in March of 2020 when Trump advised the American public to stay home. This is accurate in the sense what I mean is Trump correctly sees DeSantis as his biggest foe for 2024. As of right now, we had the CPAC straw poll over the summer. Donald Trump topped everybody else with 70%, but in second place was DeSantis with 21%. That's an informal survey. When you look at the betting markets where people can bet who will win the 2024 Republican presidential nomination, right now, 37 cents of every dollar are being bet on Donald Trump, and 28 cents of every dollar are being bet on Ron DeSantis. That's a smaller gap than the straw poll in July suggested. We also have so-called real polling. There's a Harvard Caps Harris poll from 2 months ago where Donald Trump was polling 47% among registered Republicans and independents in the primary poll. And that was very far ahead of DeSantis, who was at 10%. But again, everywhere you look, Ron DeSantis is running second. Sometimes it's a pretty distant second. Sometimes it's a pretty strong second. So now Trump is starting the attacks, and so are Trump's cronies. Remember this from last week? Here is Donald Trump in his interview with OAN calling out Ron DeSantis. He doesn't say his name. He doesn't say his name, but it's abundantly clear that he's talking about Ron DeSantis here as someone who has gotten the booster and won't admit it.
It's something out there. But after now so many months of the vaccine being administered and these side effects and Americans' questions of it, do you reconsider your push for it, or what's your view now on the vaccine in general?
Well, I've taken it. I've had the booster. Many politicians, I watched a couple of politicians be interviewed, and one of the questions was, did you get the booster?
Now that he's talking about DeSantis here, there's no question.
Because they had the vaccine and they're answering it like, in other words, the answer is yes, but they don't want to say it because they're gutless. You got to say it whether you had it or not. Say it. But the fact.
So that is an indirect attack on Ron DeSantis. And then also Roger Stone has been going out there as Trump's kind of lapdog, for lack of a better term. Roger Stone publishing to, I think this was on Getter or Rumble or I don't know who the hell knows. Roger Stone saying Trump sometimes President Donald Trump hits it right on the nose. Ron DeSantis, Yale, Harvard fat boy, can't get out of his own way. Not smart, not honest, and not going to be president. An unknown congressman with a bad haircut and an ill-fitting suit until Donald Trump made him governor. I know where he was when he was missing. Ask Emerald Robinson. That's a reference, of course, to when Ron DeSantis was MIA for 2 weeks in the sort of middle to end of December of last year. We covered that. Ron DeSantis also being attacked by Roger Stone in a new video that has been released.
Here's my beef with Governor Ron DeSantis. Ron DeSantis was an unknown congressman with a bad haircut, an ill-fitting suit, and an undistinguished record in Congress until President Donald Trump's endorsement lifted him to the Republican nomination for governor of Florida. And then, because Ron is such a boring and piss-poor candidate, President Donald Trump, with the able assistance of Susie Wiles, had to visit Florida twice to drag Ron over the finish line to become governor of Florida. Now, Governor Ron DeSantis refuses to put his own presidential ambitions on hold until President Donald Trump has decided whether he wants to run again.
So that's interesting. It's what Roger Stone is saying is that the correct thing to do, the respectful thing to do to show deference to Trump would be for Ron DeSantis to say, this is Donald Trump's nomination to turn down. I'm not ruling anything out, but I would not run against him. That would be what Roger Stone believes would be respectful.
I consider that to be an incredible act of disloyalty and ingratitude. Governor DeSantis says that I'm a convicted felon. Well, actually, I'm a former convicted felon, thanks to the pardon by Donald Trump. But if Ron DeSantis isn't careful, he will soon be a former governor of Florida without the active support of President Donald Trump.
So that's a reference to 2022, because remember that one of the most interesting 2022 gubernatorial races is that of Ron DeSantis, right? And I want to make sure I'm not getting that wrong. Ron DeSantis 2022 campaign. Yes. Okay. Yes. Ron DeSantis is running. He's up for re-election in 20. Just making sure I get that right. So why are they so aggressively going after DeSantis? Because they see DeSantis as a threat. It's very clear that this is 2024 posturing. It is not only the Trump side attacking DeSantis, as I told you before, Ron DeSantis saying he wishes that earlier he would have pushed back against the things that Donald Trump was doing and saying early in the pandemic. New York Times reporting, Mr. DeSantis shot back Friday, criticizing Trump's early handling of the pandemic and saying he regretted not being more vocal in his complaints. This is potentially a fascinating showdown in 2024. And my priority in it is not just the kind of disaster porn of a really ugly Trump versus DeSantis primary. I would love that from an entertainment perspective. But at the same time, going from the entertainment side to the important practical matter, I think 2024 is going to be really tough for Democrats. If it's Trump versus Biden, I think Trump wins. If it's Trump versus Kamala Harris, I think Trump wins. If it's DeSantis versus Biden, I feel less strongly, but I still would lean towards DeSantis. I mean, I think there's a real uphill battle here. And of course, there's a lot that needs to happen. The 2022 midterms, two more years of governing, and then we will see. But I'm not feeling thrilled about any of this. So what I'm hoping for is that a really ugly Republican primary damages whoever is the eventual nominee. We're getting very, very far ahead of ourselves, but that's the thought process right now. We have a voicemail number. That number is 219-2-DAVID-P. You can call absolutely anytime. This is so funny. This is almost beyond parody. You guys, if you've been listening for a while, might be aware of all of the different anti-vaccine people that regularly call in. One such person is this guy, Eric from Massachusetts. He's been calling in for 2 years. Every one of his predictions is wrong. He cites non-existent data. He says this about the vaccines, that about the vaccines. His new thing is that they're about to close the vaccines. Like a dollar store might close at 10. The vaccines are about to close, he says. Take a listen to this.
Hey, David, it's Eric from Mass. What are you going to do when the vaccines are closed? Because that's what's going to happen next.
No. They're just going to be closed down. They're closing them down.
I've been right about everything I've told you. I know you.
He has not been right about anything he has said, by the way.
But I'm wrong, but I'm right. And what will you do? How will you backpedal? What will you say? You're going to have to admit you were paid off by pharma. That's what.
We have received no money from Big Pharma. If anyone wants to try to prove otherwise, which you would fail to do, Democrats don't pay us. Big Pharma doesn't pay us. George Soros doesn't pay. No, they're not paying us. Why would they? They have no reason to.
I'm just wondering, do you have a backup plan? Because this website thing you got going on is about to crumble.
Right. That's what we call the circling the drain meme. For the last 15 years, every day you can find at least one YouTube comment saying, wow, this show is almost completely dead. And every month we are bigger than we were the month before. It's quite remarkable that they're still repeating that one. So no, the vaccines are not going to be closed. They are going to remain open. On the bonus show today, the website to get free COVID tests delivered to your home is up and running. I've ordered mine. We'll tell you how to order yours, when they're going to be going out. Puerto Rico has gotten the green light to end its 5-year bankruptcy. We will talk about what's going on. And the Supreme Court is having quite an anti-mask problem. Trump appointee Neil Gorsuch just ignored a request from the Chief Justice John Roberts for him to wear a mask out of respect for Justice Sonia Sotomayor. What is going on, and why is Neil Gorsuch such a vile person? We will talk about it on today's bonus show. You can get instant access to the bonus show by becoming a member at joinpacman.com. Don't miss it. Every day you get the bonus show as a member. You get 6 hours earlier than everybody else, a commercial-free full episode of the show. Don't wait till 9 p.m. Eastern or for clips to publish. Become a member. You'll get the show 6 hours earlier. Sign up at joinpacman.com.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT. In sound from way out.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Folks, glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song.
From the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject.
Pose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
It's one thing if it's a minor incursion and then we end up having to fight about what to do and not do, etc. But if they actually do what they're capable of doing with the force amassed on the border, it is going to be a disaster for Russia.
President Biden's predicting Russia will soon invade Ukraine as diplomatic talks continue in Europe. We'll speak to Nation publisher Katrina Vandenhoevel. Her latest piece, Stop the Stumble Toward War with Russia. Plus, we talked to Katrina and Ralph Nader about President Biden's first year in office and the Senate's failure to pass voting rights legislation after Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema sided with Republicans to block changing the filibuster rule. We'll also hear remarks from Senators Raphael Warnock and Bernie Sanders.
Is changing the Senate rules a radical idea? Oh, my God. First time in history we're about to do it. Never been done before. Oh, well, really, not quite.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Democrats have failed in their bid to change Senate rules in order to pass major voting rights legislation. On Wednesday evening, Democrats Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema joined all 50 Republican senators in voting no on a change to the filibuster that would have allowed the voting rights measure to move forward with a simple majority. It was the fifth time this session Republicans have successfully used the filibuster to block voting rights legislation. That capped hours of debate Wednesday that saw some Democrats compare GOP-led voter suppression efforts to racial discrimination under Jim Crow. This is Georgia's Democratic Senator, Reverend Raphael Warnock, one of just three African Americans in the Senate.
History is watching us. Our children are counting on us. And I hope that we will have the courage to do what is right for our communities and for our country, the courage to cross this bridge, to do the hard work in this defining moral moment in America for the sake of the communities that sent us here in the first place, for the sake of the planet, for the sake of health care, for the sake of jobs, for the sake of being able to argue for the things that we care about.
This comes as Republican-led state legislatures have passed more than 30 laws restricting ballot access and have introduced at least 400 more. Mother Jones reporter Ari Berman tweeted, quote, "It's completely undemocratic that 41 GOP senators representing 21% of the U.S. can block bills supported by 70% of public that expand voting access for tens of millions." President Biden capped his first year in office Wednesday with a marathon two-hour news conference in which he blamed Republicans for stalling much of his legislative agenda. It was Biden's first formal news conference since March. Speaking to reporters in the White House, Biden said he expects Russia will invade Ukraine, but predicted that President Vladimir Putin does not want a full-blown war. He said Washington and NATO's response to a Russian invasion will depend on its severity.
Do I think he'll test the West, test the United States and NATO as significantly as he can? Yes, I think he will. But I think he'll pay a serious and dear price for it that he doesn't think now will cost him what it's going to cost him. And I think he'll regret having done it.
We'll have more on Biden and Russia after headlines with Katrina Vandenhoevel, publisher of The Nation magazine. We'll also speak with Ralph Nader about Biden's first year in office and the rest of the news conference yesterday. The Supreme Court's rejected a request by Donald Trump to block the release of some White House records to the Congressional Committee investigating the January 6th and